So this is Romans lesson 2, called Universal Abdication, kind of a strange name for this, but you'll see why we call it that. I first want to really quickly go through where we've been, so we know where we're going. Particularly in Romans, remember the way Paul's writing, it builds on one another. And so he will hint at a subject, and then you'll go, Well, wait, I don't know everything about that subject. And then he will go back to that subject. If any of you have ever homeschooled, there's a curriculum called Saxon Math. And Saxon Math does exactly this. And they found it's the best way actually to learn. You introduce a subject, you have them practice, and then next week you start with that same thing and you go to a new one. And then you go around and around and around so that you build on always doing that, which is how we actually do it here. It's why I go through the review. So, but Paul actually writes like that in Romans. He introduces a subject, he gives you a little bit, and then the next chapter, he gives you a little bit more on one of those subjects. And then the next chapter, he gives you a little bit more on one of those other subjects. So he builds. So we're gonna define some things, and you're gonna say, well, wait, what about, and Paul will anticipate your whatabouts. And he will actually use a rhetorical method to answer those questions. So we need to review where he's been so we know also where we're going. Context, Roman context. We have the social context is honor, shame. That informs kind of every other part of the context of Rome. We have the political context where peace, the Pax Romana, peace at all costs, which means you suppress anything that's kind of different. And you make sure that everyone's remaining there. And their religious context was the imperial cult, where the one who had the most power was the one who got to decide everything. And he was called the Son of God, the Lord of all. That was the context that Paul was living under, that all of his recipients were living under. The Roman Church, we know, was divided, and was divided by ethnicity, which also meant theology. It was divided by geography and economics, and it was also divided by structure, by leadership style. Both the Roman context and the Roman Church context, very similar to ours. Whether you're religious and studying the Bible or you're a secular historian, both of them would agree the Roman context is very similar to our context. We actually were built on that idea of what Rome was. The author, Paul. Remember that he was originally a Pharisee, so that will determine his style, how he writes. He's going to write in legal terms. That will make a lot of difference for where we're talking today. But his prophetic call will inform his purpose, where he's going to, and that is a prophet always calls people to where they are not, to someplace else. It's always an exhortation, and all of his letters are exhortations. But he also sees himself as a priest, and that will inform his goal, where he's going with this. Not just move from where you are, not just grow, but grow so that you get to the place where you're actually in a Sabbath space of all together worshiping God. And the big context that we always have to keep in mind, and we will definitely look at that we'll hit that hard this week, is God's story. Remembering that creation is ordering for function, is functional ordering. Function is a sign from outside, and that's what gives you your existence. That is called functional ontology. We'll talk more about it today, but hopefully you've listened to Sabbath or you remember Sabbath. That's really important to understanding Romans 1. God's assigning function, though, and assigning his order is actually for a purpose, and that is so that he can create an environment where humanity can flourish. And he wants humanity to flourish. He wants humanity to be the sons of God that he's created them to be, so that they can manage that order, keep that order, and grow that order so that all humanity can live with God and God can be God, reigning and ruling without obstacle. So God has a style, and that is by assigning function. God has a purpose, that is to assign function so that humanity can flourish, But God's telos is always about humanity living with God in reality, where God is God, humanity is who they have been assigned to be, and they live without obstacle. So that's kind of the context that we've talked about, and that context always informs what Paul is talking about. Paul begins his letter with this receiving the invitation is given. That's really what he's trying to get at. But instead of just saying it, he's going to show them by his own example. He's unashamed at this example. In his culture, he should have been ashamed of being a slave of Christ and not a slave of Caesar. And yet he says, this is what I've been called into. This is where my existence begins, because I've been given and assigned a function, and that function is a representative messenger and servant of God, a privileged position. I understand that I have been called to that. And not only have I been called to that, but I've been called to be joining with others who've been called to that. And he's very adamant about this throughout, but he shows by example, by the way he treats the Roman church, by the way he treats the Jewish believers, by the way he treats the Greek believers. He says, I'm joined with all of you for the very same purpose. And that purpose is to bring about what is essential for life for others. Bring them to obedience of faith. Bring them to a place of trusting God as God so that they also can fulfill the function they have been given. And he does that, as we notice, he names value to everyone, not just the Greeks, right, the wise people, but also to the barbarians. And this is essential that you know this right from the beginning, that Paul sees worth in everyone. He doesn't call anyone out for their worthlessness, but he sees worth in all of them, and he sees that they need to have their worth reestablished. So that's key as you go look at all these, because he's going to come down hard on the places where we have decided against our own function. He also is going to continue to allude to the culture's power paradigms. He's going to allude to the fact that the honor-shame system doesn't really work well, because it's always about striving to be better than someone else. It's always about comparing ourselves to others. And it just doesn't go anywhere. It means you're always working hard to get somewhere, but you actually don't have an end goal, because you can never be the best of everything in the world. So he says it doesn't work. He says the culture's method of peace doesn't work. Suppressing everybody and making sure everybody is the same doesn't work. We know that in our own society, right? He's saying it doesn't work. There is a different kind of peace, and that kind of peace is actually going to show that diversity coming together as one under one God is what's going to work. And the culture's religious paradigm doesn't work. This idea that the one with the most power gets to become the God and have their will obeyed. It doesn't work, and yet Paul says, you keep on thinking that it's going to work, and it doesn't. So all of that, Paul says, his idea that he's been called into existence to join with others, to bring what is essential to others' life, all of that for the purpose, for the telos of God being seen as God. So that's where we've been so far. And I purposely ended in the middle of the memorization verse. And I did that because we really need to grasp onto what it is that he's talking about when Paul talks about righteousness. One of the hard things I think about the way that we practice our faith is that we like sound bites, right? So we like things just really succinct. Give me just a really good definition and I'll run with that. The problem with that, and that's actually a human tendency. We do that so that we can process quicker. The problem with that is when we don't stop and go, but there's more to that definition, there's more to that word, is that we start to extrapolate those in different places where they don't belong. And so we need to kind of pull back and say, what about our definition of salvation? What about our definition of righteousness? What about our definition of glory? These are gigantic things for us to know. And when we pare them down to a small word, we lose some of the impact. And today, particularly, we're going to see some huge impact when we recognize the bigger ideas that are behind those words. So all that to say, that's why I stopped in the middle of the memorization verse. So we're going to start with 17 or 18, where it says, "For the gospel, for in it is revealed the righteousness of God." So he's saying, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It's the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. But it all in the gospel, in this good news that a new king has come, that a new order is being established, the righteousness of God is revealed. And so what would you say is the typical definition of righteousness? How do we usually define righteousness?
Right relationship with God.
Right relationship with God. That's pretty typical. And actually, that's a fairly good, succinct way of saying it. The problem is, particularly for Paul and how he's getting there, particularly when we start to go farther with righteousness, is that we lose some of what it really is. And so for Paul, as Paul writes, and he will write this throughout his letters, righteousness is actually a legal term. So we always think of it as a relationship term. It's actually a legal term. And it's a legal term having to do with a standing or a status. So basically, innocent or guilty type of thing. Are you innocent or are you guilty? And since it's a legal status, a legal standing, it actually has to do with how you stand with some law, some agreement, some contract. And of course, when we're talking about God, we're always talking about one type of contract, and what is that?
Covenant.
So really what righteousness is a right standing as far as the covenant is concerned. And because covenant is always about relationship, now you can see how we've pared it down to, oh, right relationship. The problem is we need to understand that it's a status. It is an indication where you stand in relationship to the covenant of relationship. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about that, then we understand that God stands in the right space. He's innocent of going against the legal covenant. Remember, covenant is a legal binding contract. Therefore, it stands in the courtroom. And of course, Paul's a lawyer. That's how he's going to see. So when we talk about righteousness, particularly in Romans, well, what we're talking about is a faithfulness to fulfill his contractual agreements. So that God is faithful to fulfill his relationship agreements. Not just that he's faithful and he has this warm, fuzzy idea with you, this warm, fuzzy relationship. It's, I have never eliminated anything in the contract that I have made with you. When it says, it is in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. That is how it is revealed. God's faithfulness to humanity is revealed from faith to faith. So through agreements of relationship, the covenants he's agreed to, that's the from faith. So let's just quickly, if you've been through covenant, you already know all of the covenants. But when he talks about the covenant, and Paul doesn't really use covenant actually in this book, that's what he's referring to. And oftentimes, I think a lot of commentators will say, and a lot of theologians will say, well, we're talking about either the Abrahamic covenant or the new covenant. I would disagree with that. I think that what Paul is talking about is all the covenants. Because if God stands in right relationship with the covenant, then he stands in right relationship with all the covenants. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important that we just quickly go through those covenants and recognize where he's been faithful to the agreements he's made. Remember, God is the one who's initiated all these covenants. He has been faithful to all these covenants, and then we'll see why it goes from faith to faith. So, God's faithfulness to the covenant, the first covenant. Anybody know what the first covenant is? The Adamic covenant, right? The covenant with Adam, with humanity. And that covenant says, I'm going to agree to adopt humanity as my son, the sons of God, right? Giving them a relational connection that has a function attached to it. That's the first covenant that God makes. Paul says God's been faithful to that. He's been faithful to make sure that he will always be attached to humanity as sons of his and as representative of his. He's been faithful. We'll see how that moves. Next covenant, the Noahic covenant. And there is his agreement to not destroy the whole earth again. And in that is implied, but to restore the earth and to make a place for humans to reside with him in Sabbath. So we have the Adamic, we have the Noahic. What's the third one?
Abraham.
It's funny, isn't it, how we always have to think through. The Abrahamic covenant, right? Big covenant. This is the covenant that most people look toward. The Abrahamic covenant says, I'm going to agree to choose a people for myself so they can expand the blessing, the environment of flourishing, to the whole world so that it, my telos can happen, so that we can all live together in Sabbath. He's been faithful to that as well. He agreed to choose a people to act as his representatives and then expand that blessing. The Mosaic covenant is the next one, and of course, a lot of times we call it the Sinai covenant. There he agrees to be God, Israel's God. Now you would think, well, hasn't he already promised to be Israel's God through Abraham? If you're going to look through all of the word studies, you would recognize that with Abraham, he agreed to actually be his associate. Like Abraham, when he calls Abraham his friend, that actually means associate. You're going to work with me on my plan. When he calls Israel to Sinai, he actually calls them and says, I'm going to be your God. In other words, I'm going to be your husband. So remember that the Sinai, the Mosaic covenant, is actually a marriage ceremony. That's how it's referred to all through the Old Testament, and you'll see some references of that to the New. After the Mosaic covenant becomes Davidic covenant. And in the Davidic covenant, he agreed to bring a ruling Messiah through that line from Abraham all the way through to David, establishing his order through a representative. And the last covenant, of course, is the New Covenant. And there he promised to put his own life in his people so that they might be enabled to live in Sabbath as well-functioning image bearers. That's just a really quick idea of where the covenants are and how God has been faithful to his relationship with humanity through the covenants. But it says, from faith, that's from the faithfulness of God to faith. How then did he carry out that faithfulness? How did we see that faithfulness? He passed on his faithfulness to his son, who then was faithful to all the covenants. So that when we look back at all the covenants and we recognize his son, Jesus, actually fulfilled all those covenants. He took on the Adam role and he faithfully embraced his function of son of God. Jesus took on the Noahic role, beginning with waiting and worshiping. We could spend a couple days on just this. But it's beautiful to see what Paul is trying to say is, God's faithfulness was passed on to his son, who was faithful also by fulfilling all of those roles. He was faithful in the Abrahamic role because he became the representative of Israel. He was faithful in the Mosaic role because he faithfully led his people out of a disordered environment to a new place of flourishing under God's rule. He was faithful to the Davidic rule because he ruled by, how do we rule? By naming, tending, and making space for barbarians. We're going to add that with Romans. And, of course, Jesus actually became the new covenant, which all of those covenants actually find their fulfillment in because he allowed us to eat his blood, to drink his blood and eat his body, inviting us to share his Sabbath life, being Lord of the Sabbath. So what we have here is God's faithfulness in the covenants passed on to his son, who was faithful to the covenants, And his son, it does say from faith to faith, but then it goes on to say what? As it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. So it is from faith to faith, by faith. Because if God the Father passes on his faithfulness to Jesus, Jesus is faithful to the covenant and the function he's been assigned, Jesus passes his faithfulness on to the church, his bride, us, who become faithful to the covenants by taking on the role and functions that we've been given. That's what it means to receive the gospel in all its givenness. That is, that we live by faith. The righteous, the ones who are made right, we'll get into that later, the ones who trust the order and environment as given by Jesus and cooperate with this order, are the continuation of that faith. What does that remind you of? From faith to faith, by faith.
Pericritic
union. That's what's happening here. That's why looking at those words are so important. They're all connected. So that by faith, we live because we receive Jesus' faithfulness to the covenants, taking on his role. And Jesus received his faithfulness from God, who established these agreements with humanity to be related with them in some absolutely amazing ways, in which we'll get to see. So, do you have a little clear idea of what that verse means?
Yes.
My guess is, even if you've ever memorized that verse before, it was almost a, okay, that's a really cool sound, but I don't know really what that means, right? I mean, for many years, I look at that and thought, what does that mean, from faith to faith? And it's funny how some of the older commentators will say, oh, that's just a hyperbole of Paul's. I think, no, it's not hyperbole of Paul's. Paul will use hyperbole. This is not it. So again, it is this beautiful flow of receiving from the Father, Jesus does, and then he gives out to his bride, and the bride is supposed to continue on and do that. So, from faith to faith, by faith. But then we need to look at the other side of righteousness, because it says not only is the righteousness of God revealed, but what? The wrath of God is revealed. That seems like it doesn't really fit, does it? If God's faithfulness is revealed in the gospel, how is it that his wrath is also revealed in the gospel? So, it first says that his wrath is revealed from where?
From heaven.
Right then it tells you what is happening, why he's so upset. Because where is he, what's his tell us? Where is he supposed to be dwelling?
With humanity.
Where?
On earth.
But he's from heaven. What does it say? Why is he wrathful? Because something is an obstacle, right? There's an obstacle in the way of him dwelling with humanity. He is being kept distant from coming to dwell on earth in Sabbath space. Why? And this is where his wrath is focused. Because of what?
Our unrighteousness.
Our sin.
Give me the exact words.
Ungodliness and unrighteousness.
Suppress the truth and unrighteousness. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness.
Thank you. Okay. Against what?
All ungodliness.
Okay. Against all ungodliness and unrighteousness. So that all refers to both of them. All ungodliness, all unrighteousness. The reason you need to know that is because that all connotes a universal desire. We'll get there in a second, but it's universal. Ungodliness is a separation from God as God. Universally. And if righteousness is a right standing in the covenant relationships, a faithfulness to keep the covenants of righteous of relationship, what do you think unrighteousness is?
Lack of faith and lack of
a lack of faith to those covenants, a lack of faith to those functions, right? If the Adamic covenant was, I'm going to agree to assign value and function to humanity as my sons and my representatives, then the unfaithfulness is to say, not taking that on. So unfaith, unrighteousness is unfaithfulness to God as the source of your existence, to God as ruler and determiner of what is good, and finally to who you are, which is where Paul is going with all the last part of chapter 1. So I'll tell you a story. I've told it before, but it's the best illustration I have. I have a sister-in-law who has 4 kids. When the 2 youngest ones were young, she took them to the mall. I'm going to say they were maybe 7 or 8. Certainly knew what they were doing. She took them to the mall, and at some point, they were not happy with mom. Mom wasn't giving them what they wanted. Mom wouldn't let them go where they wanted to go. And so they snuck off in the mall. Now, I even thought about this. Context changed so much, right? People don't go to the mall very often anymore. At that point, when our kids were little, there was lots of things happening about kids getting snatched, right? Mm-hmm. Usually at malls. So that's the context. So they run off, and my sister-in-law is frantic. She is looking everywhere for them. She can't find them for a long time. She went to see if she could find a security guard. And she sees a security guard walking toward her, and he has her 2 kids. He has Matt and Carrie, and they're coming, and she's just relieved. And the mall security guard says, "Ma'am, I think I found your kids." And he says to Matt and Carrie, "Is this your mom?" Mm-hmm. And both Matt and Carrie said, "We've never seen that woman."
Oh, oh my gosh.
And no, exactly, all right, as a mom. So think about it. In that context, people were stealing children, and Liz is like, What are you doing? That you're mad, you're carrying you're my children. No, we've never seen that woman. She was frantic, she didn't know how to prove it. Eventually she proved it by showing the officer that she had pictures of them in her wallet. Today it wouldn't even go, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And finally she got her children back. Now you have to think about how Liz walked out with her kids and the repercussions of that, right? What did you say?
So mad.
And so we have
For the
right reasons.
Yeah.
The wrath of mother and the wrath of God. And so it says, the gospel reveals also the wrath of God. And it reveals wrath because wrath is a part of the good news. And where is his wrath shown? I'll get back to the story, but we'll look at wrath uncovers our shameful secrets. The shameful secrets of our heart. And what is God wrathful against? Unrighteousness, ungodliness, a separation from him, the source of our life, the source of our existence. He's wrathful at our pulling away from and not assigning him as our authority, not acknowledging that. And that wrath is found at the cross. That's where we see God's wrath. Because remember, Christ was assigned a function to take on the rule that we had given ourselves. So that the cross reveals that humanity was not receiving the environment that God was offering them. He offered them a new environment, Jesus himself, where we could actually flourish. A place where diversity, man and God came into unity, and a place again that we could flourish. But what does humanity do with this new environment, this new place where we can live? They kill him. They put him on a cross and they kill him. And when you think about that, I want you to note who takes part in that killing. It's very interesting, if you follow John, that John delineates exactly who takes part in that killing. First of all, Rome takes part in that killing, right? So the political paradigm takes part in that killing. Remember, the political paradigm is peace at all costs, which is exactly why they crucified Christ, right? There was upheaval, disruption out of that. And they know what they're doing because Pilate says, "Shall I crucify your king?" So Pilate knows what he's doing. He knows that he's making sure that peace at all costs, even if it costs one man his life. The religious paradigm, right? The Jewish leaders, the priests, the Sadducees, they all want to retain their power. Remember, their power is coming from Rome. They want to retain it. And so, you know what they say? They say, "We have no king but Caesar."
Right.
It's the religious leaders that say that. They also say, don't write on his cross that he is the king of Jews. Write, "He said he was the king of the Jews." This is the religious leaders. Remember that it's all about what is going on with the context of Rome. Well, if we have the political context against making sure that they are going to kill this new environment, if we have the religious leaders making sure they're going to do away with this new environment, we also have the people doing away with it,
right?
The social. They don't want the shame on them, and so they say to Pilate, wants to release Christ, and they say, if you release him, you're not a friend of Caesar. In other words, that is treason against the real king. The people do that as well because they don't want to have shame on them. This is shameful to them. And so what the cross reveals is that humanity so much is so concerned about their own honor and status, whether it's in the political arena, the religious arena, or the social arena, that they will kill the new environment that they've been given where they can flourish because they want to have honor. And that's where it will always lead to. That kind of environment of I need to get honor for myself will always lead to death. And the cross is a revelation of that. It reveals that our independent ways of grabbing honor rather than receiving honor from outside of ourselves will always end in death. It is an intentional reversal of roles, or at least an attempt to reverse roles. So wrath is grace because it reveals that that's what's going on. And I want to just, I really have become more and more in love with the book of John, because John really gets to the core of some of these. John will summarize the rejection of Jesus as the environment of flourishing really well. Remember, we talked about in Genesis that how God orders a place for humanity to flourish is by bringing diversity together so that it produces some kind of life, something essential for life. And John will actually go through that exact same thing. He knows that the three systems that God has established, Jesus will reflect. And so John talks about the system. The first system is, of course, time, where light and dark come together and make a day, right? And so John will refer to Jesus as the light that comes into the darkness. And yet the light that came into the darkness, John says, they rejected. They could not see. And then John will use further on, that's in John 1. In John 4, he will talk about the second system, that is the waters of heaven and the waters of earth coming together so that they move and provide water, provide sustenance. And of course, John will say that Jesus is the living water, that his water will quench thirst forever. And yet, in John 4, Jesus says, "I'm offering you water, and you're not asking to drink it." And then John goes on in John 6 to talk about the third system, where seed and earth come together and produce food. And John says Jesus was the seed that was buried in the earth, that he died and was buried, but that he rose as the first fruits, as the food that men could eat. And yet, when Jesus tells them that before he is buried in the earth, he says, my body you must eat, my blood. And what happens after that?
People left.
People left and said, we cannot accept that. So John then summarizes for us that Jesus is that environment that God is bringing to us again where we can flourish, and humanity rejects it. I don't want the light that coming into the darkness. I don't want the water that can quench my thirst. I don't want the food that can bring me life. So when we go back to the story of my sister-in-law and her response of wrath, why wrath? Sydney, why would you be angry at your children?
That they would disown me or reject me.
And that's exactly it. Because what Liz knew is, if you continue to reject me, this is going to be dangerous for you. Maybe the first time this happens, she might give them a warning. But if this continues to happen, this is pretty scary, right? Because what would happen to children who continue to reject publicly their parents? Where do they get to go?
DCFS.
And how? What kind of an environment is DCFS, as far as we know? Right?
But it's almost like there, now you're going into a place where I don't have control to, like, take care of you, to protect you.
Right. Because my control is for your benefit, right? And in my control, in the environment that I'm making as a mom, you don't have to strive to belong. You belong without deserving it. You just belong. But you, in pushing me away and saying you're not my authority, they are brought to another place where now they have to earn belonging.
They would have learned a lesson.
Yes. Right? That would happen.
And it's not like God can't have control over it, like, but it's our choice. He's not going to force that.
Exactly. So that what we see then is wrath is there for the purpose of resurrection. It reveals God's ultimate authority and rule. And we'll continue on with that story just a little bit. But it's as if, remember we talked about I was going to give Ashley a gift. See, and she's not in here because she didn't want to take it home. So here we have this terrarium, and I've put it together exactly how the directions have said, right? So I've received the invitation as given, and I put in the stones, there's soil in here, there's seed in here, and there's carbon in here. I don't know why the carbon. I think it takes out
the smell.
Mm-hmm.
Takes care of it.
Oh,
smell.
Okay. So it's all there. I've received it as given. And eventually, you're going to see grasses grow in here. It's savanna grass that the seeds were. And you're going to start to see them grow, I hope.
Don't give it to me.
But what is it going to look like if I don't receive? Well, I decided, I think that's rather ugly. And I don't really want to display that on my fireplace mantle. What I would rather see is something that matched my decor. Right? And I want the fruit right away. So I'm actually going to put fruit in here. Green and yellow go. And I like them. This actually comes with this, but it doesn't come up. You don't put it on until after it starts growing. But it goes with my decor. Yeah. It kind of works for me. Right? So I've got my greens and my yellows. I mean, right? Doesn't that work well? Yeah. So that I will display. Here's the problem. Side by side, at first, you're like, man, this looks nice. We're going to see in the weeks to come what's going to happen between the two.
That stays the same.
It's going to rot. That's
going to rot. Can you put some wrap over the left?
So this is actually going to grow, right? And we're going to see flourishing. And it's going to be green and it's going to match.
I mean, that one will be green too.
But, yeah. Wow. Oh,
It'll turn white first. So we'll see that this actually dies. So what we see with the cross and resurrection is the two side by side. Here's the cross, and here's the resurrection. And the cross eventually dies. You want a rule? Well, you want it to go according to what you like? Okay, go ahead. This is what it's going to look like. That would be the judgment of no life, no growth in the rejected jar, alongside the one that will eventually grow, is what you'll be able to see side by side, the cross and the resurrection together. So that what Romans says is, for in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who do what?
Suppress the truth.
That means that there, right there, is a present tense, so it means it's continually, a continual active action. So this all comes out, if you're reading the Greek, you know that. That is an intentional action. It's intended to hide reality for a desired benefit. So the problem is not, Paul says, the problem is not ignorance of the truth, which is what the Greeks would always say is, if you're doing something wrong, it's because you're ignorant of the truth. It's basically because you're stupid. The Jews would say, no, you sin because you succumb to temptation to follow your urges. In other words, you just didn't have enough willpower. Paul says it's neither of those. You did know, and you wanted. It wasn't anything about your willpower, but an active campaign to go after the lie. So what Paul is saying is, you Jews and or you Gentile believers, you're trying to claim that you're superior than the other side of the church. Jews, you think you're superior because you are morally superior. Greeks, you think you're superior because you're culturally superior. You're naturally wise. This undercuts any claims to any superiority.
There's also not just that, but it's a willful squelching and denying and erasing.
Yep.
And, you know, it's not just going after the wrong thing.
No.
It's punishing good things.
Yes. And so this suppressing of the truth is actually suppressing what they know is true, right? It's suppressing reality. And so Paul says that it is an internal sense of what you already know. Humanity is created with an inward sense of who God is. This is a suppressing of who God is that we suppress. We know internally that someone is in charge of us. By the works of creation, we know someone's in charge of all this. We know that humanity did not create this, but that someone's in charge. We have an external sense from creation's order, pulling us back. The words here, again, pull us back to creation. He says creation. So we've got to go back to Genesis. Paul's been hinting at this from the very beginning. We're talking about creation, recreation. What's happening in Christ is the same as creation. So that you have an internal sense of who God is. You have an external sense of who God is. That he is the authority. Maybe not all of his attributes. In fact, it says you basically only know two, internally and externally. The first is that he has eternal power. Power that always exists. Not just momentary when needed, but a power that always exists. And remember, always comparing it to the context. And the context is, Caesar has all the power right now. But it is evident that the power Caesar has is not eternal. Why is that evident?
He's going to die.
Not, he's come and gone.
Yeah, not only is he going to die, but what about...
He succeeded.
What about before? What about when he was a little boy? He was a little boy at one point who had no power and no authority. He has power for this amount of time. So he doesn't have eternal power. And yet we know that there is someone who has power that never ends. The order of creation is a testimony because no man, no human being can create time and weather and food supply. No man can do it. We can manipulate as much as we want some of that. We can manipulate food supply, but we cannot cause seed and dirt to come together and create something new out of it. We cannot change time. We manipulate time all the time, but we cannot change or even create time, nor weather. And we have tried. So we know internally, externally, that there is someone with eternal power, and that that someone is divine, that he has never been anything but God, and he will never cease to be divine. The Caesars were once boys and not kings, and they will at one day not be king. They might be overthrown, or they might die. The order of creation stands as a testimony because of the assigned function of things. That although we disorder the function that has been assigned, it continues to be sustained. The assignment to creation, the assignment to birds flying, and fish swimming, and grass growing. So that the suppression of the truth of who God is by intentional rejection of his rightful position. And whenever we reject God's position, we reject his personhood as well. Because that's what Cindy just said, right? When you said, why would you be upset with your children? They've attacked my personhood of who I am. I am mom. I have authority for their good. And when you attack my authority that's good for them, you also attack who I am. And so God said, Paul says that the suppression of the truth is an intentional rejection of his rightful position. He goes on to say, they knew. What did they know? Somebody read it. 19.
That which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them.
Yep.
For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are out without excuse.
One more.
For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened.
So it says, even though they knew God, they knew who God was, and when they talk about they, and Paul is really good about this, he's talking about they, but he's bringing them to a point where they're going to realize, oh, we're they. They knew God, but they did not honor God as God. So we need to look at that word here, honor, because it's doxa, which is glory. They did not glory God. They did not glorify God as God. Glorify actually means to ascribe to one the status of king and authority. The word glory, and this is important because glory is one of the key words throughout Romans. And we so often bring it down to a very small, kind of ethereal idea, like glory. Well, what is glory? We like to use the word, but really don't have a good definition on that. First of all, glory in both Old and New Testament is a metonym. Do you know what a metonym is? Language, a metonym. A metonym is a concrete word that we use in place of a bigger idea. So, for example, in England, sometimes they would say, the crown has decided that everyone will abide by this law. the crown is a metonym. Did a, what's a crown?
Inanimate object.
Right. It represents the authority of the queen, right? So that a metonym usually represents a bigger idea. The authority of the queen, her right, because she's queen, has decided this. Sometimes we use it here and we say, the court has decided that, and we so often use it that we kind of think, well, yeah, the court, the people on the court. No, I'm saying the court. The court is a noun, an inanimate noun. But it means, it usually means the judge, who is in authority, has decided. One other metonym that we have used lately, we talk about first responders. Right? Literally, what is a first responder? The first one to respond to anything, right? It's just somebody who responds first. Since 9/11, we now use it as a metonym. What do we mean when we say first responder?
Paramedics.
Heroes. The ones that come in when there's a disaster to help. The specific.
Let's go a little deeper, because that's
heroes,
what we really mean.
Firemen and face difficult situation first.
Yes. So people who put their lives on the line for others in a disaster, right? Because right now we have inundated the word first responders with something amazing, right? Right? Before, it was just policemen. Now they're first responders. They have been inundated with a bigger idea. Does that make sense to you? Mm-hmm. That's what a metonym is. So glory is used as a metonym throughout Scripture. We usually, if you look it up in any lexicon, you're going to come across the definition of splendor, light. But remember, it's a metonym. It actually represents the authority of God as king, or the authority that God gives. So when we see glory, this is one of those paradigm shifts that you've got to get out of, or you will not understand Romans. Glory does not mean, I mean, how would you define glory? Right? It's a really hard one to define, right?
God.
It's like
experience.
Rays of light.
Rays of light, right? Yeah, we have these kind of ethereal ideas of glory. It's a very concrete meaning. The authority of God.
Scare. I mean, you fall on your face. I mean, that's overwhelmingly.
It should be, right? It is. It literally means the authority of God. Authority as one who rules. So, they knew God but did not glorify him as God. They did not honor him as the one who has authority, as the one who has the right to decide the order of flourishment. And then it says, they knew God, but they not only did they not honor God, they did not what?
Give
him thanks. In other words, not only did they know that God was the one of authority, but they knew that his authority actually produced good things for them. And yet they did not give him thanks. This is all part of suppressing the truth. No, I'm going to suppress it. I'm going to hide the fact that God is in authority. God's the one who has the right to rule. And God makes the good environment for me. He's the one who gives me a place of flourishment. I'm not going to thank him for that. Because if I thank him for that, then I necessarily say, oh, you're the one who actually gave me the good environment. When what I really want to do is flip that. And it says that they gave themselves to futility. You know what the word futility means?
Worthless.
They gave themselves to worthlessness. Because they want to earn their worth. We want to earn our honor. When I refuse to live in reality, I necessarily choose disorder and thus no value. Because order is that God assigns me value, that God gives me value by assigning me function. I say, I don't want to look at God as the authority. Therefore, I'm not going to allow him to assign me function. Therefore, I'm choosing worthlessness. Because I want to start from scratch and build up my own worth and my own honor. What Paul is saying here is then he evokes the foolish and wise paradigm that they've already talked about, right? Professing to be wise, they became fools. He says, you're so adamant about not naming worth to people who are fools. Yet your refusal to live in reality is actually saying, I'm a fool. So by your own way of judging things, you're choosing to be a fool. You're choosing to be one worthless because you want to gain your own worth. You're assigning yourself unworthy of honor. And the problem is, when you live in a fantasy world, you can't see reality. How many times, I don't know about this, but if you've ever been so addicted to perhaps fantasy games and or perhaps shows, that all of a sudden you begin to think that that's the real world and you begin to talk like that, right? I've never gone to any of these, but have you ever gone to any of those conventions where it's all about Comic-Con or, yeah, any of those, and you take on those characters? Sometimes it's hard to separate, right?
Or Downton Abbey.
Thanks, Pat. I only did it once. What Paul is saying is you've chosen to step outside of reality and live in there, and then you're pretending you're wise. How foolish. How foolish to suppress the truth, to suppress the reality that God is the God of authority, that God is the authority over all things. Because when you do that, you also suppress who humanity is. Because you've rejected the reality of God's rule, you also necessarily reject your own role then. And so he goes on in verse 22 to say, in verse 23, and you exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image. Somebody read all of verse 23.
And exchange the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures.
Now, if you've already been following Paul and you know that he's talking about Genesis 1 and 2, you realize what he's doing is repeating Genesis 1:26. Before we go there, I want you to turn to Psalm 8. Somebody read the whole thing for me. Loudly, please.
O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babes and infants, you have established strength because of your foes, to still the enemy and the avenger. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him, that you have made him a little lower than the heavenly beings?
Ooh, stop. Wrong translation.
Yeah.
The word is God. So read it as God instead of heavenly beings.
Yet you have made him a little lower than God and crowned him with glory and honor. You have given him dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, and also the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens and the fish of the sea, whatever passes along the paths of the seas. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth.
When we are exchanging the glory of God, what are we exchanging? What does Psalm 8 tell us?
Put out images.
What did you say, Jen?
Authority.
The authority.
Like
who's got whose authority?
Our
authority.
We're supposed to be ruling that, right?
Yes. So when it talks about the glory of God that he's given you, Psalm 8 says, to reign and rule over the fish and the creatures, you're exchanging your glory, your authority, for an image, for something else to rule. The image of humanity, the image of creatures, the image of birds and fish and creeping things. So this exchange of glory is not, I'm not exchanging the authority of God for something. I can't do that. I'm exchanging the glory he's given me to rule. This is pivotal for you to understand all of the rest of Romans. That the glory being exchanged here, when I suppress the truth that God is God, is that I therefore exchange what he's given me, authority as vice regents, as sons of God, I exchange that for something lesser that I decide. And that lesser thing that I decide is the creatureliness of all of these things. First of all, being my own creatureliness. I let that be ruler rather than me. We'll go into that more, but I'll continue in that. But I just want to I want you to sit with that for just a second. Because I hope that's a paradigm shift for you. I hope that you understand how big of a deal this is that Paul is making. Why Paul has been over and over, starting with Genesis 1 and 2. His focus is on who you were made to be and what you've given up. All humanity has given this up. Humanity was assigned glory. He was assigned a representative rule, kinship and kingship. He was made to bear God's image and likeness, but we returned it in exchange for another image, man's image, his creatureliness, birds or animals. And he exchanged that those might rule over us. We have allowed our creatureliness to rule over us, rather than us ruling over the creatureliness, the creation. We turn over the rule, the order of rule, instead of ruling over. We are ruled by. Why would anyone make such a bad transaction?
Ignorance.
Independence.
Not ignorance. He already told us that, right? Not ignorance.
Independence.
So I'm going to play a really short clip. Let me set this up here. How many of you have seen the King's Speech?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So you know that it's about a true story, right?
True story.
You know that it's true about King Edward, who was, so King George the V, and I know this is not the best to see, but I didn't want to bring out my big one. George the V. Is the current Queen Elizabeth?
You have dogs on your screen.
Slave dogs. It's not. It's the commercial that comes before it. It's not my screensaver. George V is the grandfather of the current Queen Elizabeth. Okay. So when he died, the kingship went to his son David, whom he took on the title King Edward. So King Edward became king. King Edward, when he was David, was a known adulterer. He had many affairs with married women, many. At the time he became king, he was having an affair with not only a divorced woman, I mean a married woman, but a woman who had also been divorced. So she was divorced, currently married, and they were having an affair. So that's where this picks up. He's been named king. He's having this affair. It's short. I'll say it again, what they say in case you don't catch it. It's a little bit dark, but I just want you to get the feel for what's going on. So his brother, his younger brother, is talking to him about, what are you doing? You're having this big party, and what are you doing? So that's the setup here. What he said there was, he plans to marry Wallace. His brother says, you can't. You're the head of the church. Remember, the king is the head of the Church of England. You can't do that. It's against church order. It's against what God has said. You can't marry a divorced woman. He says, why can't I have the right to marry whom I want to? And his brother says, you have privileges. And he says, but I want rights. Mm-hmm. That's the point. Why would someone make a transaction? What happened? Do you know what happens to King Edward?
He abdicates
the throne. Mm-hmm. He knows that, he finds out that if he marries Wallis Simpson, the government will leave. So that means everybody in Parliament will leave, and England will, this is right before World War II, England will collapse. So instead he abdicates the throne. And he makes this famous speech about how I can't possibly go on and rule this land if I don't have what I want, if I don't have this, the woman that I love by my side, is how he puts it. I want the rights of a commoner, he says. And his brother says, you're not a commoner. You have privileges. And he says, but it's not the same thing. Absolutely, it's not. But here's where we always get it wrong, right? We think we should have rights. Yeah. The right to rule our own lives. And yet you've been given glory. You've been given the privilege of representing, he's been given the privilege of representing England, ruling them so that they flourish. But he wants his rights more than the privilege. Mm-hmm. You can't have both.
And we take it a step further because we think, oh, look at how much he lost. Look at what he gave up.
Yes. And that's funny, right? Because we always turn it in this, oh, what he gave up for the love of his own sexual desires. He gave up the privilege. He said, forget all of you English people. I want my rights. I want to be able to fulfill my sexual desires here. That's what Paul is talking about. We exchange the glory just like King Edward did. We exchange the glory of being kings, the glory of ruling, For the desire to have rights rather than privileges, the right to rule ourselves, to determine order for ourselves according to how we think, according to how we feel, according to how we see things. In other words, we demand a material ontology. Remember this? We want our created form to determine our function. Remember that our emotions, our will, and our thoughts are part of our form. And we want those things to function as the rule rather than a functional ontology where God says, no, this is your purpose. We want our purpose, our function, our worth to come from what we feel, what we think, and how we see things. When we do so, we establish a whole different environment and a whole different economy. We go from a transformational economy, a transformational environment where we can actually grow, to a transactional economy, a place where I will only get what I put in. Because I want the merits I received to be what I earned. What does the abdicated King Edward get for his transaction? He traded in the glory he'd been given for sexual desires. What does he get? Well, first of all, he created chaos in England for all the peoples. He was demoted to the Prince of Wales. And really, that didn't last long because he just couldn't be involved in politics. He had no honor left. And so they basically exiled him to the Bahamas and became the governor of the Bahamas. He married Wallace Simpson. They moved to the Bahamas and he became governor there. And after that, he retired to France. He never lived in England again. He lost his home, his people, his family. It made a huge rift in his family. And his purpose that he was schooled for. He lost all of that. That's what he gained in the transaction. He gained the woman he wanted to be with, and yet he never went back to England. So, Paul says that's exactly what we're doing. That's exactly what every human being has done. We've exchanged the glory for our right to rule ourselves, for the right to have our emotions rule us, for the right to have our thinking rule us, for the right to have our willpower rule us. And so, what does God do for that? Somebody read it.
Therefore, God gave them over in the lusts of their hearts to impurity so that their bodies would be dishonored among them.
So God hands them over to judgment. God gives humanity over. In the midst of their demand to be ruled by their own lusts, their own desires, God gives them over. The word give over means a movement, a transfer from one area, one environment, to another by delivering them to prison, committing them to be under a new ruler, their own disconnected from reality desires. What they're going to find, Paul will say, is that their demand to have their own creatureliness rule over them, they're going to find that it's an oppressive ruler. That their disordered longings will be very oppressive. That they will rule the entirety of their humanity, their bodies, their hearts and wills, and their minds. And it will be an inescapable environment. They will find they have no power once they've been handed over to their own desires. They will have no power under that rule because they gave it up. The entire humanity is trapped. You can't power your way through it with your bodily strength. You can't use all your willpower to not let it rule you, and you'll not be able to think your way out of it.
That was bleak.
Very bleak, right? Very bleak. And basically, that's what they told King Edward. Like, you can't do this and then a year later decide you want to come back. Once you give up the power, you have no power to change it.
Sounds like hell.
Yeah, right? You have literally no power. You've put yourself under this rule and environment, and you gave up glory for it. So it says, Romans says, that God gave up humanity to impurity, to dishonoring their bodies. That's a judgment. So the dishonoring of the bodies is the judgment God gives them. It's not the choice, but the judgment. Dishonor means to make shameful, to take away the glory or the assigned function of the form. In other words, you are now under the rule where you will use your body, and you will think that you can use your body for other things than what it was meant to be. So when it talks about this, it means all sexual sin, not just the homosexuality that he will talk about here, but all sexual sin. In other words, things like prostitution and adultery and pornography, you will be under the rule of using your body in ways that are shameful, in ways that they weren't meant to be used by. Why that judgment? Because it's what they asked for. Do you think my sister-in-law, Liz, would have ever given her kids over to the authorities, of the mall authorities, the security guard?
Probably not.
What if it happened every day?
Yeah.
Why? Why would she do it?
Teach a lesson.
For them to be able to see side by side, this is what you had, this is what you want. What is it? And even more, what if she knew for a fact that at some point she would go down to DCFS and rescue her children out? Right?
She'd let them go.
She'd let them go. Yeah. As hard as it would be. I don't know how many of you have either been in that situation with your own children or have had friends that the child is so belligerent about authority that they have to give them up. I have a friend who had to do that, a young adult, and she had to see him go homeless. Yes, it was the hardest thing she ever had to do. But she also knew judgment is for their good. He's no longer homeless. But sometimes that's what happens, and that's what is happening here. This is what God says is, I'm giving them over to the oppressive ruler of their own desires, of their own thoughts, of their own disconnected from reality way of seeing life and the world. I'm doing that because you keep on saying that's what you want, and you need to see that it isn't life. What did they ask for? What is Paul saying that humanity asked for? The ability to create our own environment. Right? We want to trade the truth for a lie. We want to trade reality for fantasy, what's in our head. We want the ability to rule ourselves. We are naming ultimate value to our creatureliness. We have no king but Caesar. What will give us what we want? And we want space to worship ourselves. We want to follow our desires and serve our desires. When we talk about being ruled by what we were to rule over in the form of humanity, it means our form, our will, our thoughts, our emotions. This is not attending or caring for creation, but assigning a function that has not been given. I'm going to assign function to my emotions, to my will, to my view of things, how I think about things. But I don't care for my body when I allow my cravings for sugar to rule me. I don't tend my toddler when I allow his craving for playing in the street to rule me. I don't attend my assigned function. I don't tend my assigned function as God's image bearer when I allow my cravings to look like the models on TV, or my cravings to be more attractive than my neighbor, or my cravings to be liked, or my cravings to be successful, or my cravings to be the richest person in the world, or the smartest person in the world, or the right person in the world. When I allow those things to rule me, I'm not tending my function that God's given me. He's given me a function to rule those, to tend them, to make sure they have what they want. And sometimes having what, give them what they need. Sometimes giving what they need is not giving them what they want, right?
Sometimes they don't know what they need or what they want.
Sometimes we don't, right?
That's right.
And why not? Because of this connection, right? So Paul is saying that we allow our creatureliness to be the ruler. We've given over our place of glory. And then he ends, he always does this. He gets so wrapped up in this that he finally says, "For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature," the creatureliness, the form of the creature, "rather than the creator, who is," by the way, he wants you to know, "blessed forever, amen," who is the one who is flourishing, who is the one who knows what a flourishing environment is for us, who is the only one who can supply that place of flourishing, who is himself the place of flourishing. He alone is that place of flourishing. And Paul will do this over and over again. That amen there isn't just a, "Okay, amen, I'm done, we're going on." It is, "Amen?" This is what he's saying to his audience. "Amen, don't you agree that he is the only one that knows how to make an environment for us for flourishing? That he is the only one who has the authority to say, this is good for you, this is not?" He wants them, he's carrying them along. Because, right, it's always been about they. And so they're carried along and say, "Yes, they need to do that. They need, why, we do that too. Karen just did it," right? Karen said, "They don't know what they want."
That's right.
But
it's
the
us, right?
Yeah. This whole thing is like, yeah, we don't know. We don't know. And so he gives them over to their to dishonored bodies, and then he says to the judgment of degrading passions. Degrading means to deprive of privileges. Oh, we've heard this before, right? Depriving of privileges by taking on the right to follow your sexual lusts. And so here he brings up homosexuality as an example. Now, I know I have all summer thought about this verse and thought through and prayed through, knowing that this is a place of controversy for us right now within the church, within our culture. This is a tough place to be. But I have to look and see, what does God say about this?
Right.
And he's already built up here. But we need to know a couple things. First of all, the Roman context. Male homosexuality was culturally accepted across the board. Number one, it was common for masters to have their slaves as their partners. For male masters to have male slaves as partners. Sexual partners. It was also common for powerful men in business to have their workers as their partners, their male workers. It was common. It was accepted. No one thought anything of it. It was just, that was just how it went.
Can I add to that?
Yep.
And also, like, so women were seen as less than men at that time, and so it was not, like, men didn't see, like, having sex with a woman instead of a man as something as equal, so like,
correct,
they would want to have sex with other men in order to, like, it was like a power play and a
it was to show thing. Themselves, right?
Yes.
Even more.
Yes.
So again, it's an honor thing. along with that, homosexual marriages were also common. So when you sometimes you have this, when people use this as a center of argument before, for or after, or for or against, they always talk about it's just pederasty. No, it's actually male homosexual marriages were also fine, no problem. The thing that wasn't accepted was lesbianism. Ashley just said women were less, but also, do you remember what the role of a woman is in an honor-shame society? Protect from shame. So that was out of bounds. Male homosexuality was perfectly fine. But in the church context, Israel had always known that it was not according to God's order. So for the Jewish Christians, they have no problem with Paul as he's talking about this. The Gentile Christians, for the majority of Gentile Christians in the Roman church, they would have come from the lower caste or the lower society, which means they were either slaves or freed men, had been slaves, which meant they already knew the circle of it being accepted, but they were always on the bottom, right? They were always the ones who were told to be in these relationships, and they didn't really have a lot of choice. There were slogans that talked about it was a freedman's duty or a slave's duty to have relations with their masters. So the Gentile Christians wouldn't have had a problem with Paul going against this either because they saw the abuses. In other words, in the church, as Paul's writing to the Roman Christians, this is not a controversial issue whatsoever. It's like me saying, everything's controversial today, so it's really difficult for me to come on and say anything. Yeah, right. So it's not controversial at all. He's not bringing this up because it's an issue for them. He's bringing it up because it's not an issue for them. So he's not using it here as a sermon on homosexuality, nor should we. He is, first of all, remember that he already gave worth to everyone, particularly barbarians. So anyone who's outside of whatever. He's saying everyone has worth. He's not listing it or any of the behaviors as people who are unworthy, only as people who are caught under the rule of their own desires. So this same-sex attraction isn't the reason for God's wrath. It is the rule that they're under because they have suppressed the truth of God as God. And others, he will go on to say, are under the rule of other of their desires. Some are under the rule of addictions. Some are under the rule of gluttony. Some are under the rule of arrogance. Some are under the rule of helping anybody so that they can be liked.
So where does Sodom and Gomorrah fall into this biblical view of homosexuality and God destroyed?
I don't really know what your question is. It fits right in there. Paul would agree
that it was okay for God to destroy the...
Yes, but not because of their homosexuality. In fact, it doesn't actually say that there. But because of their refusal to see God as God. That was just a symptom of them not seeing God as God.
It's a much bigger picture than...
It's a much bigger picture.
Gets focused on by love.
It's a much bigger picture. So the reasons then that Paul uses homosexuality as an example is because it's demonstrable rhetoric. Remember what that is? Rhetoric used that is easily demonstrated. It's a tangible picture of refusing to join diversity into unity so that the assigned function can be accomplished, that is bringing life to others. So homosexuality stands as an archetype, not as a, oh, this one is bad and the rest are not so bad, but an archetype. It's not worse than all the others. It's simply very demonstrable. It's very tangible. Here is part of what happens when we suppress the truth of who God is and his order. Then we are ruled then by our desires, whether they be sexual desires or desire to be liked or desire to have to be feel comforted. Whatever those desires are, those are just signs that we have not allowed God to be God, that we're suppressing the truth. And therefore, now we are allowing, we're not ruling our desires anymore. We're letting our desires rule us. Does that make sense to you? I know that this is difficult because of the paradigms of our society. But we focus on one issue. We do this all the time, right? We focus on one issue and then we go on. We focus on a different issue and then we go on. It'll be a different issue in 30 years from now. Every issue is going to be the same.
But the common theme with all these issues is us wanting our emotions to, we want them to rule.
Yes.
It's
yes.
Us, yeah.
This is the danger. It's the danger of taking verses out of context,
yeah.
Taking
yeah.
pieces and snippets.
And to use scripture to fight a battle. It's never been intended that way. Paul's not doing that here. Paul's just giving a very concrete example. And then he gives a list of 21 examples.
But if we're reading this correctly, we all fit in there.
Like, we all fit in there.
None of us.
Absolutely. We all fit in there.
It's kind of a little bit depressing.
Yeah. Right. But that's where Paul wants, he's talking to the church.
Right.
And he's saying, church, you think you're better than people.
Yes.
We're all in the same boat. We all have abandoned our glory given. We've all abandoned the function given. So here he shows homosexuality abandons the natural function of the body. But then he says, but then you abandon your function as rulers over your creatureliness. We've all done that. And this is why translations are so important, because then it says, when it talks about, I mean, it literally describes homosexuality, right? Mm-hmm. Women exchange the natural function for that which is unnatural. So we know he's talking about functional ontology here. And in the same way, the men abandon the natural function of the woman and burn in their desire toward one another, men with men committing indecent acts. And this is what, I hear people use this and it just gets me so mad. Receiving in their own persons the penalty of their error. Such a horrible translation. It does not mean that. There's no penalty anywhere here. What it means is, therefore they receive what they sought for themselves. They receive their desires as rulers for themselves. And like Michelle said, this goes for all of the behaviors here. We are under the rule of these behaviors, under the rule of our desires, because we have suppressed the truth that God is God and knows what's good for us and what's flourishing for us, and we've given up our own function. And therefore, we all receive the due penalty, such a bad translation, we all receive what we seek, and that is to let our emotions, our will, and our thoughts rule us. And when you think about it, isn't that true? Aren't you often doing that? You allow how you think about things. You allow what you feel. I mean,
yes.
Every day I struggle with, I did a lot of hard work today. I really deserve to eat something chocolate. And I struggle with that. I struggle with, and through Romans, I keep remembering, I'm the ruler of that desire. That desire isn't supposed to rule me. Am I going to give up that glory?
Just the word deserve. We don't
deserve
anything.
Yes.
I use this, so I start thinking that I know innately that it's wrong.
Yes, yes. And he said, wouldn't it be much better to give what you aren't deserving?
Right.
To give you a gift of glory and yet you've exchanged this. And the third one, he goes on to say that he hands them over, that God hands them over to the judgment of a depraved mind. Now, this is a little bit different because notice this is a depraved mind. All the rest have been plural. In other words, you have, so Laura Jean has different passions than I have. She has different desires that she's going to go against. We have different bodily desires because man and woman have different. But here it says a depraved mind. He hands humanity over to one depraved mind, to a collective mind. In other words, this word depraved means unable to stand the test or unable to determine what is good and fitting. Good. Remember the word good from Genesis 1? Doesn't mean morally good. It means what functions well. And so he gives humanity over to this collective mind of not being able to discern what is functioning, what functions well, what is fitting, what is good. So that they choose to do, it says here, the things that are not proper, the things that are not fitting, the things that are not good, the things that would work well for our function. We no longer can discern that. Because we refuse that connection of being representative of God, because we refuse who God is.
Jill, the Jerusalem Bible says, since they have given up divine truth for a lie and have worshipped and served creatures instead of the Creator who is blessed forever.
So that's exactly what he said, right? I want to serve my creatureliness rather than serve God. I don't want to do that. I will serve that. I will do whatever it takes to fulfill that rule of my desires. So the judgment of being under the rule of dishonored bodies, degrading passions, and a deprived mind leads to lives that are full of unfaithfulness. To living under God as God, and unfaithfulness to living as kin and king. Unfaithfulness to who we were created to be. And then he lists, and here's the thing, if the original audience is listening to this and hearing this, the Jewish Christians are going, yeah, you Gentiles, I don't know what you're thinking. That's what they're thinking right now. Because homosexuality, it was accepted in the Gentile world. Not the Gentile believers, but the Gentile world. And so the Jews are sitting there like this. Yeah, told you, you Gentiles don't know what you're doing. And so then Paul starts to list all of the behaviors that we're being ruled over because we've given up. And he starts with unrighteousness and wickedness and greed and evil and envy. And the Jewish Christians are still going, yeah, those are all Gentile. And then he goes on and he says, and murder and strife. Oh, well, why were the Jews kicked out of Rome? Because they had strife in between one another, right? So now the Jewish Christians sitting in the audience are getting a little uncomfortable, like strife, deceit, malice, gossip. And we all sit here as Americans who gossip constantly. Slandering. Hating of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents. And the reader should be going, oh, he's talking about me.
Well, now, isn't that the Ten Commandments? I mean, that's kind of what he's saying, right?
He's definitely saying, right, all of these things, we are under the rule. And what he's giving this wide berth of like, oh, you think those people are bad, but you have this, and it's ruling you. Your passions are ruling you. And then he ends with four similar things. So in the Greek, it would be read, they would all start with without. So it would be an A in Greek. Without understanding, without trustworthiness, without love, without mercy. Those all actually rhyme in the Greek. So it would be very apparent, like, oh, wait. Here's four things. First of all, I should say this. There's 21, right? Remember, Paul is always going to use groups of either 3, 5, or 7. Here he uses three times seven, because three and seven are the wholeness numbers, right? They mean wholeness, completeness. And now he's multiplying those. He uses, we use that, right? How many times should you forgive your brother? Seven times seven. Okay, so similar way he uses this. These are all rhyming words denoting a loss of something essential, good, because these four attributes were considered by both Greek and Jews to be what was essential for humanity. In other words, what he's saying is, your exchange of glory, your exchange of your intended function, results in something less than human. And that's how they've been saying what the barbarians were. Barbarians and fools are less than human. So what he's saying is, your lifestyles indicate barbaric foolishness, doing what you know is detrimental, and dragging others down in it to say, come with me. Yes, this is great. To a place of worthlessness, to a place of being less than human. And they literally thought about that as being less than human. If you didn't have those four attributes, he's saying, but you're ruled by those attributes, those lack of attributes. You're ruled by those. Because you have suppressed the truth, and because you exchanged your own glory, your own ruling authority, and you've given it over to your form, to the form of who you are. It is like saying to a chair, chair, go and do what you want. You can do whatever you want. You can be a hammer. Go be a hammer. And letting the chair be a hammer is only going to destroy it, right? So Paul is absolutely adamant that they understand that we have all suppressed the truth, that we have all exchanged glory. So while the gospel reveals God's faithfulness to humanity, it also reveals our unfaithfulness to God. And our unfaithfulness has always been shown by us suppressing the truth of who God is and who we are. We all have rejected the roles of glory and exchanged our glory for being ruled over, just like King Edward was now ruled over. So, chapter one, all have exchanged glory. That's going to be our, I will have banners for each one, so we kind of have this little succinct, oh yeah, Paul is reminding us that we've all exchanged glory. This has rarely happened. We have plenty of time for questions.
What was the four withouts that you just went over? That rhyme?
That rhyme, yeah. I don't, I can't
first
say
without
anything.
Without understanding.
Untrust.
Without
trustworthiness.
What was
without
that?
Loving. Without mercy.
Without understanding.
Without understanding. Mm-hmm. Without trustworthiness. Without loving. And without mercy.
Verse 31.
I also miss, like, when he's handing us over to judgment, over dishonoring our bodies, plural, passions, plural. The depraved mind is single.
Why?
Because now
it's collective mind.
Yeah, because it's not like, well, I can't understand, like, I have a lesser understanding of reality than you do. It's all humanity. No humanity can actually discern what is fitting and good for us, what is a flourishing environment for us. So, it doesn't matter who you are, you can never reach what we know it would be the good flourishing. Without, of course, remember, Paul's always putting you on the edge of your seat. You mean like we're doomed? And he'll ask these questions. What then? He'll say, thanks be to God, he says, right? We aren't doomed. But he needs to make sure that we're all on the same level. We've all been. He's talking to the church. We've all been suppressing the truth. This is one of the things I'd like you to do this week. I'd like you to think about how you personally suppress the truth. And I've been thinking through this week, and I've been thinking a lot of things, and some of them I'm thinking, oh, wow, do I have to change some of that? But I thought sometimes it's very hard for us to answer those questions. How do I suppress the truth? How do I suppress the truth that God gets to decide what kind of an environment is flourishing? How do I suppress the truth that God is the one who orders for us? And then how do I suppress the truth that I have the authority and power to rule over my emotions, my will, my perspectives? Of course, Paul is going to talk about how we have that ability. But where are those places where I don't rule? Sometimes I think it's easier to begin when we were little and say, how did you suppress the truth that you had an authority when you were little, when you were young? Can you think of any instances that you continually were suppressing the truth that you actually had an authority?
You did something without permission?
But specifically, can you think of specific things that you would do? Maybe it's easier if you go to teenage years.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Right? Really easy then, right?
And for a few.
Yep, right. I would just constantly make sure that my parents didn't know why I was staying after school. Think about that so that it gets you to the place of where now do you suppress the truth that God is your authority? Where do you not rule over your own thoughts, your own emotions, your own will?
Is it different than, like, because I feel like oftentimes, like, I'm suppressing God's authority in lieu of what, like, the church as a whole is, like, saying. Like, I'm taking the church's authority over God sometimes.
Sometimes, yes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, yes. That will happen sometimes. And that really is saying, I want honor, right? I want people to accept me.
Right.
Right? Sometimes that occurs. But I think that, so interesting. Obviously, there's always this caveat of who are we in Christ now? But we're not there yet, right? Paul will say, I haven't reached a place where I've completely received my glory. I am hopefully receiving my glory fully. But this is why he's so adamant about receiving the invitation as given. Because the invitation is given is not, this changes what we think about salvation. The invitation is given is not, oh, you're safe, you don't have to worry about where you're going after you die. And when I think about that definition of salvation, I laugh, but I also am just cringing. Because salvation is about saving who God is to you and who you are.
Getting out of the inescapable...
Yes.
Prison.
Yes.
Of wanting to rule our own life.
Yes. Yes. So I want you to think this week about the places that you still suppress the truth. Because I think all of us have moved toward always suppressing the truth. If we're a believer, we certainly are. Yeah. But we're still suppressing the truth about who God is and who we are. I want you to think through that this week of places where you're suppressing the truth, where you're still exchanging your glory for something less.
I think the longer we're Christians, the more we do that. I think we become comfortable with our Christianity. Mm-hmm. I really do.
And that's actually what Paul thinks too.
Because mm-hmm. My daughter has a friend that she's invited to church, and she's coming out of a different faith, and she's come, and to hear her about how she gets it that God wants a relationship with her, and she has this excitement, and I realize we just become so comfortable. That's we right. Just say these words, mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
And to her, it's like, oh my gosh, this is so new. This is great.
Yes, right.
And mm-hmm. To us, we're just like, oh, we're just very comfortable with it, so we're really good.
Yes, mm-hmm. And that's exactly why Paul is doing this to the Roman church, because he sees that the Roman church is comfortable with how they are. They're comfortable being separate from each other. They're comfortable saying, yeah, you're not as good as we are. They're comfortable with not really taking on their whole function of ruling over those things. And so he's got to shake them up a little. Ashley, do you have something to say?
So do you think our, like, complacency, like as we were just talking about, like, comes from this, like,
they have.
Because it's uncomfortable
absolutely.
With this. I'm
yes.
Sitting in my
yes.
pocket.
Yes, absolutely. There, and this is why I encourage all of us to read other Christians from places that you're not normally reading from, to go to other churches, to talk with other people. This is why I'm encouraging us in the workbook. I want us to recognize that there are different aspects of looking at and not let our comfortable, like Marie says, our comfortableness with where we are make us completely complacent with who we are as rulers. And we've got to figure that out in the church. Because think about it. What is the thing that the outside world says of us? We're hypocrites. You say God rules you, but your emotions rule you just as much as mine do. Your desires rule you just as much as mine do. You're just as fat as the rest of the world. You're just as sexually promiscuous as the rest of the world. I mean, all these statistics come out there.
I remembered.
Okay.
So does it, like, the art, like, I feel like we've lost the art of confession and, like, lamenting as, like, as individuals.
Whoa.
Any other questions about, and this, it's actually worthwhile going over this again because this will influence everything else we look at in Romans, that we understand glory, what we've exchanged. Yes.
One more question.
Yeah.
It goes back to Messiah, the wrath of God, people, religion, the political realm, like wanting to destroy this environment. Which is Jesus, where we can flourish.
Yep.
But, I mean, wasn't that all part of God's plan? Like, that needed to happen so that we could flourish? Or
right. Which is, right, Liz giving over her kids to DCFS, right, would be part of her plan because she knows she's going to rescue them, and they got to see side by side what it looks like.
Okay.
So, yes. Right? Yeah. Giving over to, that's why he gives over. He doesn't give over. I mean, when we think about if my sister-in-law, if that would have happened once, and my sister-in-law would have given her kids over to DCFS right away, we would have all said, oh, that's horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But if they did it every day, we would say, oh, that's got to be really hard. I admire you for doing what needed to be done so that they can actually be brought back and saved to the right environment. So, yes, she gave them over to what they wanted so that, right? With God, there's always a so that we would recognize. Well, I think let's end there and we'll have a little time to talk with one another. Father, thank you. Thank you that you remind us that you are a God of an absolute, amazing, abundant glory, that you would give us your glory, that you would give us the authority to rule over the forms that you have assigned. Thank you that you have given Jesus as an environment that we can once again take up our function as rulers. But Father, more than anything, I pray that we would take Paul's words seriously this week, that we would examine our lives, that we would understand where we have allowed our own form to rule us, where we have exchanged the glory you've given us to rule for something so much less. Mm-hmm. Father, we pray that we would see that, because in seeing that, we would then understand that the resurrection of your Son as the human who did not forfeit his role is the place where we can flourish as a gift that you've given. Father, might we honor you. Might we not suppress the truth of who you are. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. If anyone has